Well, I'm going to start now. I guess there's no drum rolls or big introductions or anything like that. But for those of you who don't know where you are, my name is Stephen Downs, and this session is on PLEs. I never actually title things until a few minutes before I actually start them. So the title of this is actually, in the end, going to be Personal Learning, which is close enough to what I promised to deliver that I'll get away with it. I do want to note, just so you know, I always record these sessions and then put the recordings up on my website. So don't say anything incriminating. If you do say anything incriminating, get your resume in order, because it's going up on the website. Just wanted to preface this, as you can see on the screen, just a recognition of Kurt Vonnegut Jr., who from a very early age in my life was an important influence on me. And so I would be remiss if I did not note his passing today. So it goes. The talk is on personal learning environments, but I've decided to title it Personal Learning because I'm pretty aware of the audience that I'm speaking to today. And of course, it's mostly an audience from the corporate e-learning sector. That's kind of what this conference is. And if I didn't know that coming in, I certainly have seen that while I've been here. And so it's making weird noises. I hope that's the room system and not my computer, because if it's my computer, I'm in trouble. It shouldn't be my speakers. These are turned off. Yeah, it's got to be these things. Okay. Never mind. I get distracted very easily. You'll notice this. So I want to introduce this topic accordingly, although I will, before I get into heavy-duty one sentence after another, let me first say that anytime any of you, especially since we've got a small room here, so it's a fairly intimate crowd, if you have anything you want to say at any time, if you want to ask a question, make a comment, leave, do feel free. Even if you leave, I won't feel insulted. It's okay. Well, I will feel insulted, but I won't let it show much. Although I may make a snarky comment. No, never mind. I do want you to feel free to participate in this. The reason why I came here, sat in airports and on planes and things like that, is so that the possibility for dialogue existed. So, you know, I mean, if you just want me to speak, you could just as easily listen to this on the website, and I could probably have videoed it too, except I didn't really feel like it. So do take the opportunity to interact, to ask questions, to make comments. I would warmly encourage any sort of participation. I've got the official program here. I got slides, and if you make me, I'll go through them. But, you know, it's always a lot more fun if we can just sort of disregard the actual presentation and just talk about whatever we want to talk about. With that said, let me launch into, if you will, the preliminaries. And the question, again, I'm very aware that we're in a corporate environment, and perhaps I have a slightly jaded view of corporations, but it seems to me that a lot of the way things work in corporations has to do with power and control, right? Do what we tell you or we'll fire you, stuff like that. And what's happening in learning today, and not just e-learning, but I think, and not just the field of learning, but things generally, is that people who are in this field are being forced to deal with a question like, how do you teach if you no longer have power over students? How do you get people to learn if you can't make them do it? Because what's happening, and you've seen the keynote addresses, they both hit it, right? We're seeing changes coming through society that have largely to do with the personal empowerment of learners. And what that means is you can't control them anymore. What does that mean to you? this is the network age, the age of the internet. And this is the age where everything is connected to everything else. This is the age where all of the structures and all of the, you know, the institutions are beginning to break down. And even standards of right and wrong, good and bad. It's postmodernism. What is the news? It's what we decide is the news. What is art? Well, I don't know what it is, but I know if I like it. All of that. That is the order of the day. What is it? What is the age of the internet? Well, it looks a lot like the internet. If you think about the way the internet is, imagine society being structured, organized, and run the way the internet is structured, organized, and run. And you know, it's social networks, blogs, wikis, all of that stuff. But most of all, it's chaos. You look at it. It's hard to see the order there, and you can see how people have struggled with that order, trying to understand what it looks like from the inside. All we see are tubes or pipes or whatever. I can never remember. It's chaos. There are no rules. It's individual preferences. You make up your own rules. There are no rubrics or metrics. You may think there are rubrics or metrics. You may think there are best practices, but the thing is, things change so quickly, things are so dynamic, and things depend so much on point of view and context that even if you think you have these things, it's an illusion. You don't, really. There aren't peers or committees of experts. I know there's still that whole great edifice out there called peer-reviewed journals and things like that. Mostly people aren't reading those. They're reading blogs and wikis and totally unmoderated, unfiltered, unorganized stuff. That was my attempt at an explosion. So that's the context, and it's important because I always get these, well, you know, will the manager approve, or how do we get funding, and we have to get past that. We have to get past the world of corporate borders and rules and regulations and lawyers, copyright ghouls, and all of that sort of stuff, because we are moving into an era inexorably beyond those limitations. And you know, these things that may seem like they are, you know, conditions for the possibility of existence are transient. They're going to go away. The corporate structures that you live in and work under now are very recent inventions historically. And historically they will be very recent things that no longer exist to a large degree. And we're going to move, you know, all these management gurus, like, you know, they make, I know it's all marketing and that, but they do sort of have a point sometimes. You know, it's no longer command and control. It's much more about communities of people exchanging goods or services of mutual value. It's a much different corporate environment that is evolving. Okay. That was the warm-up. Yeah, I know. This is a very famous diagram. How many of you have seen this? A few. The rest of you, well, you saw it here first, okay. This is a really famous diagram. It was originally created by a researcher called Scott Wilson Scott Wilson in Britain. He works with CETUS in Britain. But really, it's, you know, in actual fact, it's a collaborative effort. There are various people around the world working on this. The personal learning environment, which is the topic of this entire talk, does not yet exist. So, you know, I'm not going to roll out the beautiful gee whiz demos and show how, you know, it all works all magically before your eyes, because it's not built. And it might never actually be built properly, so-called, like that. There's a school of thought that says the personal learning environment is more of an idea than an application. Here's the idea. Now, Scott wrote this did this diagram in prehistory, which is to say about a year ago. And so at the center where he's written future VLE, what we really mean is personal learning environment. This empty circle is the personal learning environment. Most of the action in a personal learning environment happens outside the personal learning environment. The idea here is that the learner uses this application or this set of applications or whatever and accesses their resources that are scattered all over the internet. They store and retrieve their photographs from Flickr or some other service like Flickr, now that I'm mad at Yahoo. They put blog posts on LiveJournal or Blogger. They keep to-do lists with 43 things. They have alerts. They have personal hosting, all of this sort of stuff. All the things that are listed under the heading of Web 2.0. The idea here is that they all exist all out there, but you access them, you interact with them through your personal learning environment. Now, how's that for a perfectly muddy concept? One of the earlier attempts to create one was called Plex. This again is from CETUS in Britain, and I don't like it. Sorry, Scott, but. And I don't like it because it looks like one of these institutional applications with lists of files and things like that, even though it says learn three chord rock guitar, which I'm all in favor of and I think should be a major part of corporate learning. You think I'm kidding? Nonetheless, it looks like something Microsoft would build. My contribution begins with a little application called MyGlue. And MyGlue is a very simple little application. All of these Web 2.0 services have what are called RSS feeds. How many of you are familiar with RSS feeds? Good, I don't need to do the song and dance on RSS. The idea of MyGlue is that different RSS feeds from different applications and from different people, in fact, are brought together, they're run through some sort of filter, in this case a topic filter, and that produces a real simple sort of thing, right? And now, I did not actually test my internet connection before I started, so, and it works. There's MyGlue in operation, and as you can see, it's harvesting these different feeds, and here are the results from these feeds, and these are live results. And that's all there is to it. Real simple. This concept is at the heart of the personal learning environment. The idea of bringing in content from multiple sources and presenting it in a single environment. I was very pleased with MyGlue. Really proud of myself, in fact. Oops. Oh, I always get that wrong. So there's two icons for PowerPoint, right? There's a little one and there's a big one. Right? And of course PowerPoint has two display modes, right? There's the editing one where you have the little version of the slides, and then the display version like this, the big version of the slides. So you would think, right? Little icon, little version. Big icon, big version. Backwards. You have to hit the one with the little icon to get the big picture. And people wonder why I say I once heard the expression, it's never left me. The programmers at Microsoft are otters. Otters, I tell you. All right. So the next thing, my programming is worse, but still. The next thing I did, I created something called RSS Writer. And this is a heavy-duty Web 2.0 application. Actually, I wrote it in an afternoon, so don't think it's anything spectacular. And it mostly doesn't work. It used to work a lot. And this is life in this world right now. It used to work completely. But then Internet Explorer began interpreting divs differently. And Google changed their API, and in fact, Google's API still doesn't work with any Perl application. I've written to them about that. But anyhow, what we have a bunch of different content sources. Here are the different content sources. So I'll pick something at random. I'll pick MyGlue. And now here are all the different sources that came in from MyGlue. And remember my glue, which I've just showed you. This is this bringing together of RSS feeds. And now what I can do is I can just drag and drop into this editor. So, and this is just a standard, ordinary web editing engine. That afternoon I spent programming this. I spent most of the time trying to figure out how do you copy and paste into an editing window. And then like 3 hours later I realized, oh, that capacity is built into the browser. I don't need to do anything. So also, where is he? The whole world might as well see this. Where'd he go? There's one thing when you... Oh, come on. I know you're there. There he is. One thing when you're my age, you get nephews. So anyhow, the idea here is... Isn't that lovely? I put it on Flickr. The whole world has access to this now. He didn't realize that. Right, you can do, you know, just sort of edit. And this is an editing window, but it could be anything, right? It could be a photo editor. It could be one of those Web 2.0 applications that lets you create, spreadsheets or flowcharts or anything that allows you to feed data into it, that allows you to drop data into it and then start working with it. And then once I've done doing whatever I'm going to do with that picture or whatever, then I just, and this is the part that no longer works because Blogger changed their API, I just do blah, 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 my blog name, my user ID, submit it, and now it's on Blogger. And you notice how much this personal learning environment is just a way station. It didn't store anything. It didn't access a database. The stuff came in from out there on the web. I did my thing, and I sent it out there on the web. And in fact, this is written almost entirely out of JavaScript. So there's just a little bit of Perl in the back end because of browser access restrictions. And even that's changing these days. So that's kind of what I'm thinking of as a personal learning environment these days. Didn't want to make the snide comment to you. No, I'm just kidding. sort of getting better at this. This is what I've been working on most recently. This is EduRSS. Again, these are feeds coming in, RSS feeds, and displaying it. And now for this, what I'm doing is taking it straight into a blogging engine, and now this is a different type of editing window. It's a more structured editing window. It's actually picking up the author and the journal automatically from the source. So it's doing a bit of interpretation on the way in before I'm actually doing any editing. And the reason why I want to point you to this is because, you know, we think about things like blogs and so on as consisting only of content like newspaper stories or journal articles or things like that. But we are moving into an era where we're going to have a number of very distinct content types that interact. And this is going to form a major part of this whole idea of the personal learning environment. And this system, I deal not just with these posts, but I deal with feeds and journals, but also people become resources that I link to, publications, events, all of these things merge in together. You want to think about these things as being related to each other, and I'll come back to that in this talk. But I'll just pause at this point because I'm running out of breath and see if there are any comments or questions to this point.
Yeah, Stephen, I mean, this is a fairly obvious point about personal learning, but the big question that I still need answered is why on earth we need a personal learning environment, in the sense that we've already got all these web tools and we can pull together all the tools that we use for all other purposes. Why do we have to separate learning from the rest of our life or our work?
Well, that is a good question. I don't consider, first of all, the personal learning environment to be a learning tool particularly. I know that's the name that we kind of gave it, and we probably shouldn't have. It might be just thought of as a personal environment or a personal space. We do need something like a personal space. And as you go out into Web 2.0 land, that becomes more and more evident. Right now, a lot of these applications are structured as, if you will, silos or walled gardens. How many of you tried the social networks like Orkut or Friendster or LinkedIn? Right. How many of you have the same identity on one as on the other? Right. How many of you can access your Orkut friends from your Friendster account? Right. It can't be done. They design it deliberately like that. That's why I'm really mad at Yahoo these days, because they took the Flickr identity and made it a Yahoo identity, and you can see what they're doing. Flickr is as much a social network as a photo storage site, and what they're doing is they're moving this Flickr social network into the Yahoo walls, from which it will never emerge again. And so I'm mad at them. So we need some way, some mechanism that allows us to go from one of these things to the other. More accurate, that allows the content to flow and that allows our identity to flow between these things. So that I'm the same person, if I choose to be, I'm the same person on Orkut, as on Friendster, as on Flickr, as on Blogger, and I can access my content from any of these things and move it around as much as I want.
Stephen, that leads to the question of authentication of yourself.
Sure.
And what if you don't want to be yourself, but what if I need to rely on the fact that it's me?
Yeah, okay. There's a whole spiel here. That's a great question. I want you to think about, right, you all use the web, right? So you know, if you all have experience with this, right? Think about, well, I don't know, how about your bank website? You do personal banking? You really want security there, right? So how do you access your bank website? You type in a username and a password. And that's it, right? So why does that work? Well, the principle of identity and authentication is no authentication system is going to work unless the user wants it to. The reason why username and password works fine for banking is because you don't want other people to access your bank account. Typically. You know, maybe you know, your spouse or it's not your children. But you know, I mean, you might share it with one or two people, but basically, there's a lot of incentive for you not to share that information, namely the fact that you want to keep your money. So now think about how you phrased the question, right? It was from the point of view of the content provider. How am I going to make sure that you are who you say you are, right?
No, no. And okay. I mean, how do I know which you I'm talking to?
It's the same sort of thing, right? How do you know which me I'm talking to? When you're talking to? I tell you who I am. It's that simple. The best authentication, the best identification is self-identification. I tell you who I am. People have been approaching the question of authentication as you have to prove to me who you are. Right? But there's no upside to that for me. I have no incentive to prove to you who I am. Because the only time I'm going to need to prove who I am, really, the really serious thing, the financial applications, I have incentive, and I know who I am. That's all the proof I need. And I don't need, you know, I wake up in the morning, who am I? I'm a philosopher, so I actually do that. Am I still the same person I was yesterday? I'm, yep. Okay, that'll do for me. And I'm away in the races, you know. So, I mean, there's this whole school of thought that wants users to prove who they are in order to access the system. This is this whole power thing again. Users aren't going to do that because there's no point. Why would they? oh, well, you have to access, you know, you have to prove who you are, authenticate, MAC address, IP address, all of that, in order to access the content. You go, oh, no, I'll go to Wikipedia. It's easier, and I don't need to log in. So, really, we can get away with what are, in fact, what appear to be the very lightweight identity protocols. The design question is, how do you create the incentive for a person to have an identity, rather than how do you force them to prove who they are? I have a paper on that called, I don't know, something like Authenticity or Authentication and Identification. Where was I?
Thanks, David.
Oh, no problem. Any more? I don't mean to suddenly stop. Any other? How's it going? Or except for the guy who left, how's it going so far? I want it to be relevant and useful. And and I'll be honest, this is a different crowd than I usually talk to. So feel free to, And it's all about user controls. You want me to go somewhere with this stuff, and you have to do the steering. Just, I'm going to go where I want to go otherwise. And I'm very much similar to the Titanic. So. Oops. Same thing. See, we... All right. So there's the EDURSS02 that I just pointed to. Now, that was the show part, the demonstration part. Like I said, I don't really have flashy software applications. You can go down to the trade show floor and see lots of flashy applications. Mine sort of just barely worked. Now, what am I after with this? Well, the first thing is, and I'm going to approach it this way. This is only one way of approaching it. There are many ways of approaching it. But the question gets asked, how do you find the right resource? How do you put the right resource into the hands of the right person at the right time? And when I say the word resource, I mean very generally. A resource might be a piece of text, it might be a diagram, it might be a discussion list, it might be a person, it might be an organization, it might be a spreadsheet. Anything you can think of that might be useful to someone, that's a resource. So how do we get these things and get them to the right person at the right time? It's a problem of, location and delivery, the two major things. The way the entire industry has gone to date, and seriously, the entire industry, has been to try to use descriptions. And the theory is something like, we'll have really good descriptions, and then it'll be really easy to find what you're looking for. You've all heard of probably learning object metadata, SCORM, and all of that stuff. And so the idea here was, we'll just make sure that people have good descriptions of the identifiers, the technical stuff, so you don't pull up stuff that runs on a Mac when you're trying to use Windows, all of that sort of stuff. Rights management. I love this. Some of them my favorite, the typical age range. I always go 7 to 10. Perfect. That's my level. Or semantic density. Think about semantic density, and all kinds of thoughts occur. Semantic density. Is that like dull words? Obscure meanings? Anyhow, well, that's the approach, right? This doesn't work. I did a paper just recently, a little posting, why the semantic web will fail or something like that. This won't work because this information is not, and by its very nature will never be, sufficient to facilitate discussion or discovery. Think of pornography. I can't put that in the slides or in the newsletter because it'll set off spam filters all over the place. But think about pornography, right? How do you distinguish, based on content alone, something that is pornographic from something that is artistic, from something that is used in an anatomy textbook, from something that is, accidental, whatever? Right? it's not only the content, but also the context, how it is used, the manner in which it is presented, how it is viewed, all of those things. Many properties of something depend on context. They depend on their placement within other things. Even if you think about spam, you all have, well, spam. Many of you will probably have spam filters. Your spam filters do not simply depend on the content of the message that's sent to you. If it did that, it would fail to block most of the spam that's coming to you. The only way that it's able to block the spam messages, well, part of it is using something called Bayesian filtering, the presence of this word given the presence of another word. It's also, you know, the presence of other messages of the same type. This message is spam because this other message that was like it was flagged as spam. So there's a similarity, there's a relationship between these two messages that can be identified. These spam filters depend on all kinds of contextual stuff like that. That's why you have to train them to detect what is spam, right? If you could do it based on the content alone, you know, it'd be like, you know, some plugin. You plug it in and automatically blocks all spam. But none of them work that way. Same principles apply to finding things. How do you find, well, this example, a good date? Well, think about it. What is the paradigm description of a good date? Well, in my case, it'd be female. But right off the bat, right, item number one in the description is now incorrect for half the audience. Right? And as soon as I start getting more and more detailed, you know, my description of a good date becomes less and less appropriate for other people in the room. Right? So, and this is true, what constitutes a good learning aid? Well, me should be in English, preferably Canadian English, but you know, they're hard to find. You know, there's a certain set of descriptors, again, that are going to make something good for me. Good turns out to be a relative term. But good is at the heart of the problem of locating things. Right? So what good actually is depends on a series of relations. It depends on the nature of the person doing the looking. It depends on the nature of the resource. And it depends on how that resource has been used by other people. So we need more complicated ways of describing things. We need to think of describing things not simply in terms of the properties that they have, but much more importantly, the relations that they have with other things. So consequently, at the heart of a lot of this PLE stuff, and the technical gunk inside, is about these different types of descriptions, describing not just the content, but how the resource has been used, how, you know, which people have used it, when did they use it, in what context. How do you know something is a physics resource? Because somebody used it in a physics class. That's how you know. And then things like evaluation, classification. Again, different people classify different things in different ways. Think about how movies are classified. Right? There's the Siskel and Ebert system, right? Then there's the standards board, and then there's your local church group who will recommend movies that are appropriate for children. All of these different rating schemes, and they're all perfectly appropriate and perfectly valid. Some of them you use, some of them you don't. It depends on who you are, depends on what the context is. And that's the situation, and that's why, just as an aside, that's why this whole sort of like rules and control and management goes by the wayside, because we are in an era where knowledge itself, as this says, has many authors, has many facets, the same thing looks different to different people. And in that kind of environment, things like management and systems of rules and things like that, controls, can't work. Because the minute you write a rule, it's obsolete. The minute you write a rule that works for one person, it doesn't work for the next person. The key insight, I think, I say that, this is my insight, so I'm going to say it's the key insight, but I think it's an important one, is that we have two very distinct problems that we face in our field, and they're the same problem. And that's the problem of locating the right resource at the right time and coming up with the right answer in the right situation. These are instances of the same problem. The solution to one is the same as the solution to the other. Does anyone know how I'm doing on time?
10 past 2.
10 past 2. When do we finish? 2:45. 2:45? Oh, I got lots of time.
35, 40 minutes.
Okay, good. Well, maybe I should start. Never mind. Well, all that. So here's the picture we end up with. And this is what I was trying to describe with the slide from EDURSS, where we have sets of relations between different entities. So we have the resources, we have the people, we have the organization that we might belong to, we have an event, this event belongs to another event, which is related to other events. We have some other resources, and so on. The idea here is that we're getting this web of interrelated resources. Now, again, I want to contrast that picture with the more traditional picture that I'm sure you've all seen, the idea of knowledge management, where you capture this tacit knowledge, you codify it, and you put it into a database or something like that. And again, that picture doesn't work with what we're seeing here. And it doesn't work for two key reasons. First of all, a lot of this knowledge is, as they say, ineffable. You can't even express it in words. And the classic example that comes from Michael Polanyi is the knowledge of how to ride a bicycle. And you could sit there and explain for the rest of the day how to ride a bicycle, and you still wouldn't know how to ride a bicycle. And the other thing is, as I've been saying, this knowledge depends on context. That you can't just generalize. You can't just say one thing that applies for everyone or for every case. So how do we view knowledge in this picture? Well, knowledge becomes not so much like the accumulation of facts or anything like that, but it becomes more like recognition. I don't have it on this slide, but to know something is a lot like knowing where Waldo is. How many of you know where's Waldo? Oh, geez, I would have thought. See, this is what happens when I don't know the group that I'm talking to so well. Even though I've been here, okay. I would have thought more.
Where's Waldo?
Yeah. Oh, you just, okay. You either didn't understand me or didn't want to raise your hand. Or, okay. Well, you've seen where's Waldo. They could have come out with a better name for that, too, with fewer W's. And you're looking at this picture, and you're trying to find Waldo, and then you find Waldo, right? And then that picture is ruined for you. Once you know where Waldo is, you can't not know where Waldo is anymore. So that's what knowledge is like. It's not like, you know, there's some fact in the matter, that knowledge is like seeing, like recognizing. It's like your brain snaps into a certain shape or a certain pattern. There's a whole series of what they call gestalt phenomena. You may have seen the duck-rabbit, where you see the same image as either a duck or a rabbit. Knowledge is like that, where when you look at some indeterminate phenomena in front of you, you see a pattern, you snap into awareness of that pattern. That's what knowledge is. It's a matter of recognition. It's a matter of perception. It's a matter of you being organized in a certain way so that when you're presented with phenomena, you recognize that phenomena as such and such. Is that a messy description? Or is that making sense? I'm seeing some nods, so that's good. And I always worry when I get to this part, because it is a bit of an unorthodox picture of knowledge. I'm quite certain it's right, but it's not what you would have read in the epistemology textbooks if you took philosophy. It's patterns in the mesh. It's recognition, it's similarities rather than rules and categories. Or as Jeff Tenenbaum says, the knowledge is the network. Now think about this for a second, right? Remember, knowing something, being able to come up with the right answer, is the same problem as finding something on the web. To know something is to be organized in a certain way. To find something on the web is for the web to be organized in a certain way. It's not a problem of description and retrieval. It's, who was it? I don't even have the note anymore. In the panel from this morning, someone said, bending the network. And the idea is you bend the network so that the resource presents itself to you rather than you searching through the network. It's an awkward concept. But the idea is you shape your network of connections in such and such a way that such that when you're in a certain circumstance, the resource that you want just happens to be right there. I'll keep working on that sentence. It's pattern recognition. It's being able to see things in the web. And again, this is something you've seen. This is something that you already know about. And I'm trying to describe something when really it's something that you'll recognize. You see, I'm struggling with the same problem that I'm trying to describe. So, you know, you've all seen the aha experience, or you have an idea out of the blue, or your mind leapt to a conclusion. That's your brain snapping into recognition, where a certain pattern becomes, the word is salient, most vivid, most important, right in front of you. And so you want the net to react in the same way. And the way this works, in both the human mind and in the internet, is through these networks of connections. Now, before I labeled all the connections, right? I had person connecting to resource, person connecting to organization, event to other event, and all of that. Here now I'm thinking of these connections more generally, just simply as connections without the labels. And the idea is that patterns of connectivity represent, stand for, or perhaps are even caused by phenomena. Yeah, that is a good question. And because, you know, and George Siemens, when he talks about connectivism and that, he'll talk about, well, the knowledge is in the network and all of that. But to me, that just pushes back the question another level. Okay, if the knowledge is in the network, where is it? Right. So in the mind, in the network, it's still the same problem. So the answer to your question is, yeah, it is knowing as in you know something, as opposed to how to find it. But how to find it, it's like they're two sides of the same thing. They are one in the same problem. How to find it and just knowing it, those are the same thing. Yeah, go ahead.
But I think that speaking to that your attention is in the same way that your experience, it's about how much do you use your knowledge measures how much you retain it in the same way that how much you use the web will be somewhat of a measure of how quickly you can find stuff. So it's a matter of do you maintain your level of engagement in the problem in such a way that it's easier for you to tap into what you experienced before related to that problem, and it's easier for you to tap into the resources available to you to address the problem in its current context. So I think that you have to stay. I think the problem that we have often is that we are separating learning a particular solution from being able to implement that solution in a different context, because then you go back to work and you do something else. But if you stay engaged in that problem consistently, then you come up with the solutions to it in all different contexts, and most likely solutions to other things as well.
Go ahead. But what about stuff that you don't stay engaged in, because you have other stuff to do, but you still want to know it?
Right, and I think that you won't know it if you don't stay engaged. I mean, you have to accept that.
But I mean, sometimes I'm just like virtue of paid exposure. I'm going to keep it in my head.
Well, why can't I keep it somewhere other than my head?
That's what I'm saying. Sometimes
because you still need to know where it is.
Don't really know it.
It doesn't matter if you don't know it.
But can there be tools that help me catalog it and organize it and save it so it's easy to find for me now?
You see, those tools will work in the same way as remembering it. This is the thing. But knowing where to find it is, in a certain sense, the same as knowing it. Go ahead.
What I'm trying to do is translate into my own head as far as my personal learning space or being an instructor in a face-to-face learning situation. And knowledge, facts or whatever, don't automatically come with understanding.
Right.
It's like many times knowledge, you can have knowledge stored. You have no understanding of it all, but you repeat it and use it back out over and over and over again. So of what value is that except in a certain particular context? If you have knowledge that is also plugged in with understanding, which means other knowledge or other factual information that helps you to understand the knowledge that you first got or that you're looking for, then it makes it a lot more usable in your personal life as well as your job or whatever. So where does understanding of all this knowledge come from? And I can see at this level you're working at, you need to get to resources to get information. But once you have that one, where does the understanding of information come
from? All right. Let me just the next slide of the preview. Here we go. Okay. Knowing something, Paris is the capital of France, is the same kind of thing in your head as understanding, all of the causes of the Civil War or whatever, a whole body of knowledge. It's the same thing, right? It's connections in the mind, neural connections. But you can have a set of connections that sort of stand alone. And you can have, as I've depicted here, sets of connections that are all interrelated with each other. And remembering is the activation of these connections. When you see a puppy and you recognize it as a puppy and not, say, a brick, what that means is a certain set of... we do that, though, right? It's kind of a basic skill, but it's important. Because you do not want to treat your puppies as bricks. Because they won't hold the door open. But recognizing a puppy as a puppy means this particular pattern becomes activated. Now, if it's just an isolated fact, that's all that gets activated. Just that pattern. But if it's, as you say, understanding, if it's one of a set of interrelated facts, then this pattern gets activated, but in so doing, that will activate another interrelated pattern. And now you begin to draw associations. You think, puppy. And then you think, oh, the chouch. Well, that's my experience with puppies anyways.
Can I follow up with another question?
Absolutely.
All right, and so that was my puppy.
Right.
And a whole other piece of the puzzle comes into play, which is my personal connection to that piece of information. So now my emotions are involved in it, and that's the other piece that I want to get at in order to engage people with whatever I'm searching for, whatever they're searching for.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. Here's something I use sometimes. Everybody in this room, think of the word Paris. How many of you thought of France? How many of you thought of plaster of Paris? Nobody. All right, now be honest. How many of you thought of Paris Hilton?
Eiffel Tower.
Right? Eiffel Tower. I could go on and on, right? No. Thank you. The word Paris, very simple, common, everyday word, I've just proven it, means something different to each one of you in this room. Right? And the reason why it means something different is exactly this. It is entangled in these other concepts in different ways. I think of plaster of Paris. Every time I think of Paris, I think of plaster of Paris. I know it all why. I just do. Probably because I've used this example too many times. You know? So, the question that follows from that, why am I talking about this crap that made people leave the room because it was so irrelevant? The personal learning environment is here. All right? The personal learning environment is that little spot in the network where you're trying to catch some of this stuff going back and forth. And, you know, people think of personal learning environment, they think of this thing in isolation, but it's not. It's one node in the network. Here's my PLE. Here's your PLE. Here's your PLE. Here's your PLE, and so on, right? Our knowledge, our understanding, collectively and individually, is actually constituted of patterns in this network. We know, we learn, we understand, we do by interacting with the rest of this network. Now, trying to get your LMS to do that.
Something just popped in my mind. I don't know if you're familiar with Indra's net. Indra's net is a symbolical description of how we're interconnected to all things in the universe and all people in the universe. So that sort of reminds me of here I am, and then all these other things and all these other people are interconnected to me. So I can pick and choose what one I want to interact with,
right,
and develop.
Yeah, and absolutely right. This particular diagram, you know, and the version. Right, this is a very stylized representation, and it actually presents this as a lot more organized than it actually is. I use this type of diagram because this type of diagram comes from a field in computer science called connectionism. And the whole point of connectionism is with networks that look like this, you can store information, you can conduct inferences. There's a lot of work has been done in that. Exactly the same science that explains these networks in computer science also explains social networks. You've probably heard of things like the wisdom of crowds and all that sort of stuff, social networking, 6 degrees of separation. The same logic there, the connections between individuals and artifacts in society, that same logic also describes, it's the same thing, it's the same mathematics, it's the same theory, the same principle, which is really cool.
Well, aren't you sort of doing this already with your blog? Because I was fascinated in the last panel discussion that all of you seem to know each other really well, but in fact most of you have just met each other, and you got to know each other through your blog.
Yeah.
So do we need a PLE if blogs can do the same thing?
The Well, the answer is no, obviously. And but what's happening, what has been happening historically, and this I'm capturing a trend more than anything, is blogs, properly so-called, are moving gradually over time to do this sort of thing. So mine is a bit earlier. Like I had a blogging engine on my site back in the 90s. There was no Blogger then, right? And you would have said, well, if there was Blogger, would you need a blogging engine on your site? And I would have said, well, no, but Blogger doesn't exist yet. So, the same sort of thing. We're moving in that direction. The capacity of the blogs is moving in such a way that it more robustly supports these networks. How do I explain that? Like this. RSS, which is the metadata produced by your web blog, allows you to connect one resource to another. But when you look at the RSS for a web blog, you look to try to find who wrote this particular web blog entry, you'll find either nothing, which is what you find in most RSS feeds, no indication of the author at all, or a plain string, right, just the person's name, and nothing else. It's not actually connected to any information related to the author. There's a whole other standard out there called friend of a friend, which is used to describe people in the same way that RSS describes weblog posts. Now, what's going to happen is that eventually, instead of just saying the name or nothing, when you do a blog post, there will be a link from that blog post to the information about that person. That's the part that doesn't exist yet. That's what the PLE will be, is that part, the whole collection of those parts. I'm doing this talk, right? Now, think about this. I'm later going to go back to my room. I'm going to create a blog post about this talk. And in that blog post, there will be a link to the MP3 file, which will be stored on my website because audio is too slow. There will be a link to the slideshow, and I'll actually put the slideshow on a site called SlideShare, which is a nice place to put slideshows. And then I will want to indicate that this talk belonged to this conference. Now, this conference, it has a website, but that's about it. And I'll link to the website, but I'd rather be able to link to the website in such a way that somebody coming along later, like a machine, badly phrased, a system that automatically reads blog posts and RSS feeds can actually see that connection. So they can go from my slides to my blog post to the conference to somebody else's post to that other person, you see, and the whole network gets joined up. That network isn't joined up yet. Is going to be.
But aren't we the ones who are creating that network simply by our own search and interaction with the browser?
Yes, but most of that data is currently lost. Right? Think about your own browser. At best, you've got the history, right? But the history in your browser only goes, it doesn't go that far back at all, does it? And you never use it. And it certainly plays no role in your subsequent searches, does it? All those things that it could do, right? And even your browser history has no idea whether you were looking at this page while you were studying physics or while you were studying beekeeping. Your browser doesn't know the difference between physics and beekeeping. It's stupid, and it needs to be smarter. It needs to know what you are doing. So
here's my contrary question. Why do you need that? Why would we actually, where is the benefit for us in having all that information available to us? Would we actually do anything with it?
Okay. This information, if it exists, creates this network. This network, as you browse, as you do things, this network is constantly shaping, stretching, bending, so that at any given time, if this network is robust enough, the things that we need are directly connected to the thing that we're using. What does that mean? Now, of course, that's a prediction, right? There's no system that does this yet. but it will. The idea here is that if this system works as it should, and again, this is all predicted, then if you were doing something like typing up a paper on beekeeping, your personal learning environment would be maybe in a column on the side suggesting resources on beekeeping. Or, you know, the things that you have already read on beekeeping will be right there. You won't have to go get them, they'll just be there. Because the context that you're in now is directly associated with the context in which you originally accessed these items. So the idea here is that you use the network almost behind the scenes, right? You create these connections all in passing. You don't code them all in, right? You create them by doing things. You create an association between yourself and beekeeping by going back to beekeeping sites all the time, right? And so as you keep doing these things, that's how these patterns get created in that network. And so, then you don't expend any effort to use them either. It's just, it's there. It's like remembering how to build a hive, right? You know, you don't search your memory. We're not typically, we prefer not to.
Just one thing slightly unsettling me is that this implying that our network is just in the online digital domain, where in fact, my network, and I read George Simon's book, and I sort of articulated to myself what my network was. My network was other things from non-digital, including my hard copy book, including my pin board that's on the top of my desk, the people that I speak to face to face, and on the telephone, other software which I've got which is not online,
right,
which is maybe on my hard drive and this and stuff. And what's in my filing cabinet? And that sort of stuff. Somehow or other, it would be an incomplete center point of my learning network if I'm only looking at online digital data.
Well, yeah, now in this transition environment. I mean, we're in the transition from analog resources to digital. This is, you know, one of these points in there is like, you know, I can't use paper because half of my stuff's on clay. You know, it'll never work. The clay will get all over the, you know what I mean? So the same sort of thing, right? Once, you know, imagine our world like 30 years from now or 50 years from now, and most of the stuff that you just described will in some way or another be digital. Your books, your magazines, all of your records, which you won't even keep records anymore. All of your systems will keep records for you. I mean, people don't realize just how much information is going to be and is even now being created, captured by these devices. And it's really boring information. I looked at this thing here, stuff like that.
But I think that when we're speaking about what is the personal learning environment, I think the personal learning environment is the presence of you as an identity in the physical world and the digital world.
Sure.
So all of your physical materials that contribute to your development of patterns are equally,
yeah,
as you say, are equally a part of your personal learning environment as your digital behavior.
I'm beginning to tap into some of the reasons why when we talk about the personal learning environment, we say, well, it's not an application. It's more of an idea than an application. It's a way of thinking of things. Marshall McLuhan used to talk about communications media as extensions of our senses, right? When you look at a telescope, it's as though you've taken your eye and made your eye super powerful. When you talk on the telephone to somebody in another city, it's like you made your voice suddenly able to go across huge distances. This is the same concept, except for your mind. So you think of the network that is your mind and the network that is the network. Just, you know, one is basically the extension of the other. They're one and the same thing. And so how do you think of that? How do you think that way? Well, you want this thing to be capturing the associations that you would capture in everyday life and able to use these associations the way you would use them in everyday life. And then it becomes really intuitive, right? How do you know to trust somebody? Well, you trusted them before. Well, that's what this does for you.
Why does it have to be automatic? If I'm, say, researching beekeeping and I visit 500 websites, why shouldn't I say, I really like those three and I want to remember those?
Yeah, sure. Of course you could. The EduRSS thing that I showed you, it isn't there yet, but there's going to be a little L rating thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? And, if you like something, you can rate it good. Oh, yeah, this it doesn't have to be automatic. The automatic gets rid of the boring and the dull stuff, like recording, like you're in a physics class. You don't want to write, I'm in a physics class, every time you look at a web page, right? That would be really boring, right? But for the exceptional stuff, the stuff that depends on, you recognizing, oh, yeah, this is good. Yeah, that stuff certainly should be able to enter that manually, absolutely. It's you and the system working, if you will, as one.
And where is that kept?
Depends on where you want to keep it. I have a hosting service. It's actually located in Houston. I pay them money, and they give me a web server. And that's where I would keep mine. Other people who don't really want to do it that way, they might use the Google personal environment. They probably won't call it a PLE. They'll call it something else and say, oh, we invented this, because that's the way business works. Or you might, maybe Yahoo pipes will evolve into something like that, maybe. It's like OpenID. OpenID is a way of having a personal identity that persists from one website to the next. But the thing is, you need to have your identity located somewhere on the web. And so the question, that's like asking, well, where is your identity going to be located? And pretty much anywhere. You might keep it on a website. You might keep it on your desktop, so it's only in operation when you're online. Or you might let Microsoft handle it. And you keep an extra one just in case the first one gets a virus. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
So if the web evolves into a 3D environment, what are the implications for PLE?
If the web evolves into a wiki environment?
No, 3D or virtual.
Oh, 3D environment? Not much. It'll look cooler. you read my stuff, I don't get too excited about this 3D stuff because, we've been there before. This isn't new. This software has existed like forever. If you've been around, you've seen like things like Alpha Worlds, but kind of Doom. Doom is a 3D environment, right? Yeah. I mean, there's nothing new there. So, I think the big difference will be when people can have their own 3D websites, and of course everybody will have little pictures of their houses, and then somebody will come along and, oh, that's a cloud. There'll be this whole design thing. But the neat thing that we'll see is as you browse from website to website, your avatar will go from website to website. And when you go to a website, you might see other people's avatars and engage in a conversation with them. There have been a few attempts in a Web 2.0 kind of way to do that already, to have chats on the side of web pages. Or something like that. Wikalong is one of these plugins, these Firefox plugins that tried to do that, but none of them have ever really worked. But I think having little avatars, especially if you have audio communication between them, then you can just have a conversation in audio with somebody else who's browsing the same website you're browsing at this particular time. I think that'll be the main impact. But for that to work, we have to have consistent identity. And right now, the major companies involved have been very persistently refusing to cooperate on anything like personal identity, which is why OpenID has had to come along as a grassroots initiative. But once we get those, that's probably what we'll see most of all. And then, you know, all the serendipity that creates. Although, you know, it's almost like, imagine the downtown of the city. It's like so full of all those people you could be interacting with. Isn't that wonderful? Like, you know, you're Manhattan, like a million people you could be reacting and interacting, having conversations with. You walk down the street and you go, hi. And it didn't work that way. Because everybody ignores each other. So, don't expect sudden things to happen online that don't happen offline.
I don't think I want someone
especially given some of the web pages, yeah.
I also don't think that it's I would want to be recognized as a record out there of every web page. It's a privacy issue.
It's not just a privacy issue, it's an ownership issue. Right? Who owns your data? This is an important question. Because your employer thinks they own it. The companies out there think they own it. The government stakes a claim to it. Everybody has a shot at this data but you. And that's going to be an important question. Again, it's this whole power shift kind of thing. People aren't going to put up with other people simply assuming ownership of their data. I got personally really upset when Yahoo just said, no, you can't log in with that idea of Flickr anymore. I said, well, I won't repeat what I said, but I was very upset with them because it's not up to them to decide how I'm going to log in. It just isn't. That's my identity, not theirs. And so, yeah, I got upset. Now, that's me. I get upset at things that don't upset other people. But I think over time, as these issues become more prevalent, other people will become upset at these sorts of things.
Well, it sounds like this open ID, I'm not familiar with it, but it sounds like that has the potential for upsetting everybody.
And it's so simple. Here's how open ID works. Okay. Pretend this is my website, and pretend that's some website that I'm going to. Okay, so this is my home page. This is, Flickr. Let's say it's Flickr. So here I am. I'm a web browser. I'm not a Mac. I'm not a PC. I'm Firefox. Okay. So I go, and I'm going to try to access Flickr. Flickr says, oh, you need to identify. Okay. And Flickr is a token. And I take this token, I go back now to my website. I know who I am, right? So I actually have a cookie. If I didn't have the cookie, I'd log in, right? But normally I have a cookie. So my website lets me into my website. I put token in my website. No, good, I'm done. I go back and say, okay, I'm done. And then this thing here says, okay, well, let's see. Now I'm clicking. I'm going to check your website. Ah, there's the token. Only the owner of this website could have put this token here. Okay, you're in. That's how it works. Did that make sense? You read the technical documentation, it seems really complicated, but that's all it is. It's me verifying that I can log into my own website. But what makes this work, the only thing that makes this work is my website.
But now everybody out there that you visit has the URL for your website, so they can chit-chat with each other and assemble information about you. Whereas if you're just logging in with a user ID and a password, they can't do that.
I have more than one website. I have many websites. So I can pick whichever one. My original, I did a proposal for this before OpenID came out. And what I had in mind, it was called MIDM. And that mechanism worked exactly the same, but what I had in my browser, I had up here in the browser a little drop-down, and I could pick who I'm going to be, right? And then what would happen is the identity, the address of the website, that would be in my browser header. That's why it's up here, right? And so when I went to Flickr would read the address from the header, and that's how it would know to send me there rather than there or not there or whatever. So that's going to happen. It's inevitable. I can't see it not happening. Somebody else will invent it, and they'll get lots of credit for it. But that's what's going to happen, guaranteed. So you pick your identity, and you surf as worker you, or IBM you, or beekeeping you, or, well, imagine. Right? So you have all these different identities. And that's how you keep your work life separate from your hobby life, separate from your family life, separate from checking up on your kid, whatever. Right? You keep all of these identities separate. And the more paranoid you are, the more identities you have. Mm-hmm. Me, hundreds. Let me move on, because there's still some good stuff here. How am I doing on time?
I think we're at just almost that time right now.
All right. Let's do 30 slides in 1 minute. All right, there's the PLE. Here again is this insight. Network learning, how we find things on the network. Same thing, same problem, same solution as personal learning. How we get the answer that we need. That's, if you take away one thing today, take that away. The problem of how to learn something is the same problem as how to find something on the web. The same answers, the same mathematics. We know a lot about network learning, and throw all of this, there's a whole bunch of computer science stuff. And basically we know that in these network systems, learning occurs by associations. It occurs by the repetition of relevantly similar phenomena or experiences. That's what all this is short for. Go ahead.
Wouldn't you say part of all this exists simply because we're creating it? So naturally, it's not going to ever exceed what we ourselves can imagine or create. So there's going to always be a parallel to some degree between what technology evolves to and what we expect it to do.
Sure.
And I just think it's interesting to your point earlier that everything's connected, you know, the theory that everything's connected. And so I look at this and I think this is a great presentation because underlying it for me is that our, you know, our technical destiny is already our metaphysical homecoming.
Sure. And,
we
you know,
just need to get closer and closer to trying to technologically represent what metaphysically so many folks already are adopting.
It's no coincidence whatsoever that early efforts at content management, the learning management system, were all these content-based kind of systems where you accumulated stuff because that's how people thought the mind worked. And people thought knowledge was a bunch of sentences in the brain. And it's called the physical symbol system hypothesis. Right? Sentences in the brain, that's what they thought learning was. And so that's what they tried to build. Mm-hmm. And that all falls under the heading of what was called expert systems. And they've had 30 years of it, more, and it hasn't worked. Because this is how the brain works, not sentences in the brain. I get in a lot of trouble for people across the river for saying that. But learning is this, and Clark Quinn had this sort of this yesterday, but I've been saying this. And again, I'm not the first person to say this. I won't be the last person to say this. To teach is to model and to demonstrate. Nothing else. I can sit here and tell you stuff all day, but what you're watching is what I'm doing rather than what I'm saying. To learn is to practice and reflect. There are no shortcuts. We've got, you know, this is not so much in this convention, but, you know, I go to conferences, there's a whole conference floor trade show full of people who will swear there's a shortcut and it's their software. There are no shortcuts. There are no shortcuts. This is, they say, you know, it takes 10 years to learn a language well, whether you're 1 year old or whether you're 30 years old. It takes 10 years. What is the PLE? Now I'm borrowing heavily from Clark Quinn's diagram because I saw it a couple of days ago and it was useful.
To teach is to model and to demonstrate. To learn is to practice and reflect. I thought about drawing a big line diagonally. This is teaching, this is learning. But the thing is, teaching is becoming learning. Learning is becoming teaching. To teach is to learn. To learn is to teach. It's all one activity. And then cutting through that is the learner. Now this is where Clark's diagram and my diagram differ. Clark has the motivating introduction. Well, my version of this is the motivation comes from the learner being in control of their own learning. And I've spent a lot of time in this talk explaining why that would need to be the case. Right? Identity, we've just talked about identity, identification, open ID, right? And the output is creativity. Just picking words out of the air. You don't like those words? You can probably come up with words that are similar. I'm not married to this particular picture, just something like it. And then, what is a PLE? Now we can drill down into this picture and see what it is. What is it to model something? Well, these are the different ways that we can model things, and these are the capacities we want to build into our PLE. The thing is, these are things that we're going to use anyways as professionals in whatever discipline that we're in. If we're a physicist, we're going to be busy modeling things anyways. Our learning tools are our work tools. What is it to demonstrate? Again, this is more capacity that we want to build into our personal learning environment. I especially like this thought processes. And again, this harkens back to one of the sessions that I saw where you want to convey how the expert arrives at their solution, because from the point of view of the student, it looks like magic, right? Physicist looks at this, and, oh, yeah, E equals MC squared. Got it, done. Right? But it doesn't work that way. Experts go through this false start and different theories. You're looking at a mechanic trying to fix a car. Well, nope. You know, they try different things. People who are writing software, same sort of thing. And there was I don't think he does it anymore. Jerry Cornell used to have a column called Chaos Manor in Byte magazine. I loved that. Because what he would do in Chaos Manners, today I'm going to try to reconfigure my mailing system or whatever. He tried to, these stupid little things he tried to do. Just setting up his home computer back in the days when he needed to be a bit of a computer whiz to have a home computer. And so he described what he did and what didn't work and so on. I've done a few things like that on my blog, right? Today I'm going to try to install Drupal on my website. Let's see how this goes. Well, this didn't work, that didn't work. I describe the things I was thinking as I'm trying to do it. That sort of thing. You need a place to be able to do that, which is why things like blogs and that are so useful. Practice. A personal learning environment is a place to practice. Practice, in my view, very often shades over into, not just practice as in terms of practicing, but practice as in the practice of doing something. I think, trying to think of the right way to say that quickly, there's no right way to say that quickly. I think that practicing and doing are basically one and the same thing. People, we always talk about having people in simulations and things like that. Again, I heard this yesterday. You want your actual work environment to be nearly the same as your simulated environment as possible. You want your flight simulator to actually look and feel like a jet aircraft. And there becomes a certain point where, when the outcomes aren't so critical as landing a jet, where your practice environment can actually be your work environment. I've tried to recommend involving children in things like politics, not by giving them a simulated environment, but by giving them certain access to the real political environment. And why not? And they gradually increase or step up their engagement over time. But there's no reason why their practice environment can't be the real political environment. I think children should have a hand in planning how cities are designed. I think that would be neat. And I think it would give them much more incentive to be involved in that sort of thing. Right. I wish I had more time on that. Technically, there's not a whole lot, but there is a specific mechanism employed in games, sometimes called leveling, where you start to play a game and you're playing a fairly simple version of the game, and then through various aids and supports and that, you do more complicated and more complicated. So I have an EA baseball game, and the EA baseball game will handle pretty much everything for you, and I just bat, and push the button. I'm pretty good at that. And then after you do that, then it lets you pitch. And so, you know, you aim your ball and you pitch. Well, it's a controller, right? And it handles all the fielding for me. And you can go through all the different levels. You do all your own fielding, pick up the ball, you throw it to first base. I never do that. I'll never be that good. But the idea is that the game supports you through getting better and better and better at something. So, like I say, technically they're not necessarily distinct, but not all games employ scaffolding. And Scrabble, you're thrown right in. There is no step. There should be a simple Scrabble dictionary, like an alphabet of 10 letters. Just for me. Reflection, and again, places to reflect, places to record your thought. Communities in order to have dialogue, sharing, all of that kind of stuff. And there are ways that can be supported. And then finally, the stuff that we talked about, identity, your own identity, your own workspace. And again, I'm going through this too quickly, but you sort of get the idea, right? And that's basically, which is a note of time, where I'm going to stop here, unless there's any more comments or questions at this point. Previous, yes. Oops, I went the wrong way there. Put that in there. I like the idea of having some sort of collection of creative things, and so because, you know, things that I create, and so just as I was putting that there, I put in the term creative libraries. It's like an e-portfolio, except it's not an e-portfolio, it's a library. I don't know, it's like I have at home, I have all of my notes, and all of my notes are in binders and they're on shelves, and that's a library. It's a creative library. The best I can come up with. Okay, well, I take it that was done. Thank you very much.